Welcome to Queer Writers of Crime, featuring interviews with renowned LGBTQ authors and up-and-coming talent in mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine is here to give her weekly recommendation. Hey, Justine, do you want to know who's coming up in the next few weeks?
Sure.
Okay, I'll give you a list here. We've got Joseph DeMarco, Derek Farrell, and Robin Geigel.
Huh.
Good list coming up. And if any of our listeners would like me to ask them a specific question, all they have to do is go to the website. I would love it if they would go to the microphone and actually record a question. That would be wonderful. It'd be fun to play that on the air. But if they rather just send a message via the contact form, that's perfectly okay too.
And, but, you know, it would be a good idea if they told us whether or not we should mention their name on the air, because, you know, we get here and we're like, oh, there's an email. Oh, we forgot to ask them if they wanted to be named. Okay, we'll just let this slide here.
Yeah, if I get an email, I'm able to send back and say, hey, can I use your name? And sometimes they say yes, but sometimes I don't get that. So,
right.
Yeah. So leave a message and let us know if we can use your name or not. That would be helpful. And if you go to the website, you'll find more than the names that I just mentioned. I keep the list longer there than what I'm going to list here on the air.
Because we're booked up for quite some time.
We are booked up till June.
Amazing.
So if any of authors out there have books coming up in the summer, you need to get in touch with me.
So yeah.
I try to book a little bit ahead, and I was getting a little nervous, and then all of a sudden, boom, all these requests to be on the show came along.
Well, it always works well like that.
Do you remember back in, I think it was December 2019, I interviewed Andrew Schultz, who wrote The Homos of Harmony Haven?
I do remember.
He did something really interesting with that book. Before it published, every day he sent a chapter out via email.
Yes, I actually have those emails in my inbox. I've read a few of them here and there.
And then right after he sent out all the emails, he published a book.
Right.
Well, he got high tech this year.
Exciting.
And instead of emails, he is doing a podcast.
Uh-huh.
And The Homos of Harmony Haven is a daily serial, or as I would call, a soap opera. And it has a huge cast of characters and a whole lot of stories going on at the same time. So it's not a mystery per se, but as with any soap opera, there's definitely a mystery in there. And it has all the usual other stuff. Love, sex, romance, lies, cheating, who is screwing who, you know, all the usual stuff.
Are these the original snippets, or has he picked up where the last book and email snippets ended?
Good question. This is book number two.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. It's book number two, and it's every Monday through Friday. He writes short chapters, so they're only like 5 minutes.
Yeah, I've looked at some of them. 6 to 7 is the most.
Yeah, and it's kind of wacky. If somebody wants to start off their day with a chuckle, it's kind of a quick 5-minute listen and then go about their day. I like it. It's a good way to start the day.
It is.
So it's The Homos of Harmony Haven, and it's pretty much everywhere. So whatever app people are listening to right now, they can find him on that app as well.
And that's Homos, H-O-M-O-S, right? Not homeless or anything, right?
No, Homos? No, Homos, The Homos of Harmony Haven.
All right.
So the name right off tells you it's a bit wacky.
Yes.
Monday through Friday, 5 minutes is all it's going to take, and you can find it everywhere.
Sounds good. Are we moving on to my review now, Brad?
I guess if we have to.
Okay, no more announcements, no more chatter?
No chatter. We're done with the chatter.
Okay, sounds fine. All right, so the Lambda Literary Award nominees are out, Brad.
Yes, I saw the list.
And they did something a little different this year, and I'll let you speak to the reaction to this little different, but they merged the mystery category. So there used to be a gay mystery category and a lesbian mystery category. And I don't think there was a bisexual or a transgender mystery. I think those all fell into the bisexual fiction and the transgender fiction. And this year they merged the two mystery categories into LGBT mystery. And my recollection is that they separated them out the first time because all the nominees were gay mysteries and there wasn't enough lesbian mystery. So they separated them out. And this year they brought it back, and now all the finalists are lesbian mysteries. So what's the reaction been online, Brad?
I haven't seen the reaction since the nominees came out. I can tell you the reaction when they were asking for people to send books in. A lot of folk weren't happy. It wasn't well received. A good number of people, and I'm not going to name names, but well-established authors, very well-established authors, said they will no longer be submitting their books to Lambda,
mm-hmm.
at least as long as they continue this process.
Right.
I'm personally going to stand back and not give my opinions on the matter, but I don't understand it. It seems strange to me, especially when I talk to people that were past judges and they talk about how many books they have to get through.
Exactly.
To come down to the nominees and then to come down to the winner, to lump all those folks into one pile. I can't imagine how the judges are able to go through all those books and give them justice
right.
to determine which are best.
Yeah.
I don't think it's possible.
It's quite possible that all of the nominees are cream of the crop. When they split them up, I'm not sure that all of the nominees really deserved a finalist. Maybe it was just kind of luck of the draw and the like. But I am very impressed with 2 out of 5 already.
Well, and it's impossible for us to know if they were the best ones to choose from the nominees simply because we don't know who submitted their novels.
Oh, no, you can get the submissions online, you know.
Oh, yeah, you can. I know you could last year. I didn't look this year.
Yeah, I looked early because I used to use those submissions for, you know, kind of a list of what looks interesting and you know, where to look. It's another database of what's out there. And I'm not sure that they keep those submissions up after the finalists are announced. I looked early on this, but I did not look at it at the end, and I don't really know how many books were in it. But anyway, that's the Lambda Literary Awards. They've got 5 finalists in the LGBT mystery category, and I'm impressed with 2 of them, and I'm going to recommend the second one today.
Okay.
It is called Death Before Dessert by A.E. Ridley. One of her other books won the Lambda in 2017. So she is a repeat at the Lambda Awards. This is the first book in a new series. It's called The Vanessa Harrington Mysteries. And this is the first mystery that Vanessa and her niece are into. And at the end of the book, they decided they're going to start a PI agency. And I'm looking forward to very many more books in this series. I probably won't recommend them because we've got to kind of give them a taste, but I will read them all as they come out. This is a terrific novel. Clara was a resident of London. She just broke up with her girlfriend, and then she lost her job, and her landlord has sold the building, and so they gave the tenants 2 months' notice to get out. And so she's got no job, no chance of getting another apartment to rent, and there's not really a much social reason for her to be there. So she decides, it's time for me to take a break. I am going to visit my dear Aunt Vanessa, who she calls Aunt V, in this tiny little village called Pickle Marsh, which is way out in the countryside. Then she takes the train out there. She's got her, you know, belongings in a duffel bag, her trusty bicycle. And off she goes to Pickle Marsh. She pulls into the station. It's basically a lobby with 2 benches and 1 guy. And so this is this tiny little town that she's arrived in. Aunt V is a crime fiction writer, a very well-known crime fiction writer. And they go out to Aunt V's little cottage that she rents on the grounds of a large manor, Chadwick Manor. And there's a party at Chadwick Manor. Angus Chadwick is the patriarch. He basically runs this town with an iron fist to benefit himself. Everybody in town hates him, and he invites a few select people over, the councilwoman that is working under him, and his accountant, and the neighbor, and he ends up poisoned and dead, and somebody from the dinner did it. And that basically starts out this little cozy mystery.
And this is why you should always eat dessert first.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And everything is just delightful. It's going to get a delightful recommendation because I laughed out loud at the characterization of some of these people. The councilwoman is an older woman, and that is Clara's sweet spot of attraction. And so she's interested in her, but the woman is a suspect. And for a while, it looks like she did it. And I'm not going to tell you whether she did or didn't at the end.
Well, I hope not.
Well, you hope not. It's the kind of thing where the author could go either way. It's a coin flip. You can have the happily ever after or the happily for now at the end, or you can have Clara being very disappointed that the killer was the one person in town she was interested in. But she could be the killer, or she could be, you know, the love of her life. And I'm going to let people guess on that. It's all very well done. It's very Jessica Fletcher kind of thing. I was thinking of you and how much you like Jessica Fletcher. And Aunt V has a lot of Jessica Fletcher in her. She's very bright. She puts things together. But then, unlike Jessica Fletcher, she runs a fair number of cons. And so she gets into the grocery store and starts pretending they have to shop. And she tells these lies and says, "Go ahead, Clara, tell them what we did yesterday." And Clara's going, "I don't lie very easily. And why are you springing on me?" And by halfway through the book, she's like, "Okay, so what story are we telling now?" And Aunt B says, nope, I'm not going to tell you because you'll feel very self-conscious trying to figure out what you're going to say. We'll just go it in and play it by ear."
Sounds great.
Sounds wonderful. And it is wonderful. I highly recommend this book. I think you would like it quite a bit. It's a quick read, and you can pick it up for an afternoon at the beach. And I think you'd really enjoy it. I think a lot of our listeners will also.
My stack is huge, so I could probably use a quick read.
Yeah. And this is it. This is a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to the next book in the series.
Anything else you have for today?
Recurred Tales is bringing out a science fiction masterpiece by Felice Picano. It's called Dryland's End, and everybody who likes science fiction should pick it up. It's one of those entire world-building kind of things, like Lord of the Rings or Dune or any of those sorts of novels. I think people would like it.
Marco Caracari's coming right up.
Sounds great. Listening to it. See you next week, Brad.
Hey there, Rainbow Warriors. I'm CJ, host of Beyond the Rainbow, True Crimes of the LGBT. My episodes focus on crimes committed by and against the LGBTQ community. I've covered cases you probably have heard of, such as Matthew Shepard, Brandon Tina, and the Orlando Pulse nightclub massacre, as well as some lesser-known cases like the murder of Ray Hainish, the Australian Gay Beat murders, and the suspicious disappearance of Lisa Lynn Stone. I cover cases brought to me by listeners like Penny Brummer, who I believe was wrongfully convicted, taboo cases such as lesbian corrective rape and murder in South Africa, and Pray the Gay Away camps. I discuss gay serial killers, women who pretend to be men to hook up with other women, and trans murders. I'm opinionated and uncensored. I know I'm not everyone's cup of tea, but surely I'm someone's shot at tequila. No matter what your gender or orientation in life might be, please join me as I tackle rainbow crimes in search of unicorn justice. Remember, it's not a crime to be gay, unless you're a murderer.
Today's guest,
Marco Caracari,
grew up in Switzerland, where he, over the past 50 years, worked in a hardware store, traveled the globe working for the airlines, and later as an internationally published photographer, and frequently jobbed as a waiter, hotel receptionist, or a manager of a professional studio. In 2016, he swapped snow-capped mountains, lakes, and lush green pastures for the charm of the dry California desert, where he lives with his husband, and Blackout is his first novel. And Marco, I'm going to explain to the listeners why I had you say your name. As you know, over the past month, I've been saying you're coming on the show. And I think every week I said your name differently.
You did fairly well.
Okay, good. Yeah. And I don't know why. I have lived all over the U.S. I've lived in very diverse communities. I worked in the hotel industry, so I've dealt with guests from all over the world. And I've always prided myself on names. But for whatever reason, yours has been a big challenge for me, and I'm offering my apologies for that.
Oh, don't worry about it. You're not the only one.
For the listeners, it will be in the show notes, and when you're ready to buy his book, it'll be right there for you to read. So welcome to Queer Writers of Crime.
Thank you so much, Brad, for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
Now, we're recording today, but this show actually will release on March 30th, mm-hmm. which is the day your book comes out.
Absolutely, yes.
Thank you. Happy release day.
Yeah, thank you. Doing the countdown now.
I'm sure. Butterflies in the stomach?
Yeah, I'm very excited. These are exciting times. These are also very stressful times, you know. Promotion, trying to get the word out, and of course, nervous. How are people going to react? Are they going to be as kind as some other people have been, or is it open season? And I'm just becoming a running target. I have no idea. We'll see.
Well, I've got to tell you, I've talked to many experienced authors, and they will tell you that feeling never goes away.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So just get used to that. I'm excited to see how things turn out for you, because I think it's going to be good stuff.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. No, it's super exciting to be in this particular spot of time after almost 8 years since I started with this project, to even be able to put my first novel out as my first novel, I think is kind of special. A lot of people say that their third and fourth book finally got published. I count myself very fortunate to be in that position. So yeah, I'm excited.
After over 50 years in Switzerland, you left in 2016 that you moved to Palm Springs. In your past, you did odd jobs, hardware store, worked in the airlines, you were a photographer, a waiter, receptionist. Over those years, what would you say was your career?
I'd say photography was my career. I started photography while I was flying still. I was flying for Swiss Air for almost for 12 and a half years. And during that time, I bought my first camera, started photographing men around the world, as one does. And I think that's been the career that stuck with me the longest. That did not necessarily make money, but once I changed menus just a little bit or specialty, I should say, and started to do a little bit more advertising in Switzerland, that's when the money came in. That's what I did about 10 years ago, still working with models and production companies. And then I moved my field of interest to interior design, architecture, and that's what I do now. So basically all I do all day long is photograph sometimes beautiful homes, sometimes just your average real estate property. And it's been exciting. It's stuck with me the longest, absolutely.
Well, I've seen your photos online, and we're going to talk a little bit later about them, because there's some photos I was expecting that are missing, and we'll get to those. But I've seen the home photos you've done, as well as some other shots that you've taken, and they're outstanding.
Thank you so much.
Great photographer.
Thank you.
Let's go to Blackout. Let's go with the blurb. Tell us the setup of the story.
Franco is a 43-year-old photographer who is sort of at a crossroads. He's not as successful as he wants to be. He's kind of in a rut. And he doesn't really break out of his comfort zone too much. So the one night he does and hooks up with a stranger on his rooftop for a little late night nookie, he ends up partaking in smoking a joint that he does not know is laced. And of course, it's the night he becomes witness to a murder across the street. When the cops come, there's no body or a crime scene. And he realizes he lost a certain amount of time where he can't remember what happened. Cops are not overly excited about his statements, and so they leave. And by the time they do finally find a body days later, he goes from very unreliable witness to prime suspect, and it goes downhill from there.
Who is Franco?
Well, I guess in many ways, Franco is kind of based on myself and my experiences that I had. There's a lot of stuff that's made up as well, so he's a mixture of all these things, but I think, considering this is my first book and it was my first attempt at professional writing, a lot of myself got filtered through Franco. So yeah, he's someone who would like to be in a different space at this point in his life. He'd like to be more successful, happier. He'd like to be in a successful relationship. None of this has ever really happened for him. He's failed on several levels, but he's got a really good group of friends around him. Has generally a positive outlook on life, and then basically everything goes to shit.
So despite that Franco is a part of you, you also said that he's more than that. So if you sat down with Franco and had a chat, what would you guys talk about?
Oh, man. I'd probably... That's a hard one. Well, depending on when I met him, I probably want to know how it felt going through all the stuff that I put him through. I think he's more courageous and definitely a little bit feistier than I am. So he has more courage than I do, I feel. So he's doing stuff in the book that I don't necessarily would see myself do. And I guess it'd be interesting to have a conversation with him that way. Also, during the writing process, it was interesting to know what I would do, but somehow the story and the character dictated something else. So he would do things that I would not necessarily do. I wouldn't have the guts to do. So it was interesting to see how that developed and the character sort of took on a life of his own.
So when that happened, when the characters would go in a different direction than you had in your head, did you find that frustrating or exciting?
It was both. I remember reading certain chapters again, and I thought, gosh, why is he being such a dick here? You know, he's doing this, and I would be more agreeable, and I probably wouldn't have maybe the nerve to confront someone that particular way. I'm an outspoken person. I mean, I do speak up when stuff bothers me, so it's not like I'm a total wallflower. But he definitely is more aggressive in his approach, and then he would do something where I was like, but it makes sense for the character. It makes sense for him. He is that way. But at least he, even if he reacts a certain way where I get upset with him, let's say, I understand his reasoning. And I like that he, at some point, maybe not right away, realizes that he was being a dick and that perhaps he needs to apologize to someone or whatever. And I think that's what makes us all human and make a character more human, because everybody's not perfect. Everybody's not always doing the right thing at the right time. We anger each other or frustrate each other, and then you talk about it. Or if you don't talk about it, perhaps there is some self-awareness there. So that was interesting to see how that all worked out for me.
We all can be assholes at one time or another.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not going to get too much into it, but my series, there's two characters, and one is snarky and snide, and I feel like that is me. He gets to say and do the things that I could never do in public. And then there's another character who, just this great guy, and he's the guy I want to be.
I think that's a very good description. I think that goes for I have a secondary character, the detective Aiden Torrance, of course, is kind of important to the story. And I think that's exactly what I did. I envisioned what I would try to aspire to be. And so I put a lot of that in this particular character, who is a lot more of a straight arrow, if you will, even more so than Franco, which causes frustration with him because his friends constantly tease him, oh, you're too boring, you need to loosen up, have a drink, have a whatever, you know, just stop being so black and white. And I think this other character is a little bit more that. And so he also has very good qualities and very good, what's the word? My English fails me here. Values. There you go.
If I asked Franco about you, what would he tell me?
Oh, man, you're not making it easy on me.
Other than the fact that you made his life a living hell.
Yeah, he'd be like, take a keyboard away from that douche. Oh, gosh, what would he? I have no idea. I don't know. Perhaps that despite all the crap I put him through, I always was trying to give him a silver lining or trying to, you know, dangle a little bit of hope in front of him and ultimately gave him the courage to persevere, which I guess is what it's really about. Well, what one of the themes is about for me anyhow. It was really a book about self-discovery, my own as much as my characters, being in a situation that is completely over your head, where you're totally a fish out of water, for lack of a better term, and you're suddenly confronted with all these things, and then the fight or flight, you know, reflex comes in. What do you do? And you can't weather that situation, and yet somehow there is no other way than go through it and hopefully come out standing at the end of it.
Going back to your previous careers, you did say photography for you felt like was your career. And I can definitely see why based on what I've seen. But having done all those things, do you feel like it was a period that you were searching? Like, what is it? Even as a flight attendant working 12 years and even as a photographer, have you had those feelings of, what do I really want to do?
Yeah, all the time. I have that problem of I'm presented with a question and I instantly have 10 more questions or 200 solutions and no idea which way to go. That's always been a bit of a problem. So when the airline happened, that really happened out of nowhere. I was living in Zurich already and I lived with a really good friend of mine, Jamie. She was a dental hygienist, an American dental hygienist living in Zurich. And I love to speak English. I love the English language. And so she suddenly said to me, well, here's something you could do. Why don't you become a flight attendant? Then you get to speak English all the time, because obviously in Zurich, there is no need. Most people speak German or French or whatever. And that's how that all came about. And I was a very different person then. So I thought I'd found my calling and pretty soon realized, no. I did not, but it had a lot of great, it gave me a lot of great opportunities. It was the greatest school of life for me personally and to come out of my shell. So the 12 years I spent with that formed me into the person I am today, who is a lot more outspoken, has more courage to speak up or do things, or is more adventurous than I was when I was 21. And then I thought, you know, I discovered photography during that time. And I photographed all these beautiful men around the world and I started publishing. I was fortunate enough to get my name out there and have magazines be interested. And so I suddenly had portfolios and covers all over the place, which was fantastic. And then I decided, well, I think I want something else, something more, because it's not making money. I stopped my career as a flight attendant. It was not for me to continue. And then the real estate and architecture, photography, interior, all that came along and it's fun, but something was missing. And finally, at 44, 40, whatever it was at that point, I decided to try my hand at writing. I'd always written, but never professionally. And now it's all about the writing and everything is kind of like, sure. If I have to do it, I'll do it. But I really want to focus on this. But the question is still, can I actually do it? Can I pull this off? Can I make this a career? Or is it just something fun to do that gives me creative outlet, but is never really going to make any money? It's a big question mark. But, you know, at this point in my life, I am in a position where I can at least spend enough time to try and see where this goes.
I'm a firm believer that just because a kid is a brilliant pianist doesn't mean that he has to make that his career.
Right.
And let's talk about photography. As I said, I found your shots beautiful.
Thank you.
And it's obviously somewhat of a passion because you still do photography.
Yes.
So can you pinpoint when you said, I'm done, I'm going to move on, and I'm going to write?
It probably started, I'd say maybe 4 or 5 years ago, not instantly, like when I was still in Switzerland and I was starting with this project, with the project that turned into Blackout. I was actually fairly fast. I wrote it in 3.5 months and I was like, print, I'm done, you know, call the presses. And then I was still working. I did my, sometimes I did advertising, sometimes I did my personal projects, worked with models. So that was all always a lot of fun, but the writing really was a calling at that point where I was like, no, I need to do this. This is giving me so much joy and I enjoy telling stories. But I also realized pretty quickly that I am not done. I don't know half of what I'm doing. So I need to get a better education when it comes to writing. I need to take writing classes. I need to go over the manuscript at least 50 million more times to make sure that it actually sounds American English, because I wrote it in English, but my mother tongue is German. So I had a lot of work ahead of me. And then, Mark and I reconnected. We got married. I moved to the States. And being here about a year or two I realized that writing was really becoming stronger and stronger. I'd spent so much time already at that point invested in this book that I felt, A, I love it. I love when I have an idea and I can put it on paper and turn it into something that's at least decent and then, you know, try to make it better. But it was a different outlet where the photography got not left behind a little bit. I don't always get to photograph the, and I guess that's true for every photographer, but you don't always get to photograph the things that make you the happiest. Sometimes you get to photograph what makes money. And so there is a balance of fantastic jobs that are like a once in a lifetime and your everyday jobs. And I'm very grateful for those because they do pay the bills. You know, you gotta eat and all that. But there is definitely less and less of a drive in me to do my own personal projects. I don't know when I photographed a man naked last. That was my thing for years, for decades. That was the thing I was, you know, somewhat known for 5 or 10 seconds. And that was a wonderful time. I really enjoyed that. But then I kind of went in a different direction. I love architecture, especially here in Palm Springs. I love mid-century architecture. I've been fortunate enough to photograph a lot of really beautiful homes here. But it's, I do it on my own. I'm basically, I take the photographs, I have them, they go on the website, and that's sort of where it ends. I've never really had the drive to contact all these magazines and see if they want to print them. But with the writing, it's different. And so I think the last 4 years were a bit of a struggle where I had to make sure I do the work, make the money, but find enough time to write. And unfortunately, sometimes both things come at the worst time. So it keeps you from working or it keeps you from writing. And I'm also a lot more critical than I used to be. So right now it's a decent balance, but it's up and down.
I presume that suddenly, you said it took 8 years you started this project?
Yes.
I presume that suddenly out of the blue, a brick didn't hit you against the head and you said, I'm going to be a writer. I would guess there was a spark inside of you, probably for a lifetime. Is that fair?
Yes, probably. I mean, the funny thing is really that when we were in school, so in Switzerland, in our school system, you know, you had your homework and all that sort of stuff. But let's say you were unruly during class or you spoke out of turn or whatever, you would get what we call penance. You had like additional homework to do. Everybody else got like all these crappy assignments. I always had to write my teacher a fresh new story because she knew I loved it. She loved my writing and she was hell-bent on getting me into journalism. And I was hell-bent on, you know, doing the exact opposite because I thought that if I had to write forever as a 24/7 thing, as a career, I would lose the joy. And so I didn't do that and made some decisions that I don't think they're necessary. Well, there are wrong decisions, but I guess in this career path, if you can call it that, it wasn't. I kept the joy I have for writing alive. And so I would basically write journals and stuff. You're right to say it was probably always there because I would write fan fiction when I was like a teenager. I had my own Star Wars stories and Lord knows what else. I wrote plays, but it didn't take per se, if you will, professionally until about 4 years ago, because as you said before, imposter syndrome, I am my own worst critic. And I am finally getting over thinking, I can't do this. I have no place here. Everybody else has more talent and more, you know, has more right to be here than I. I did the same with photography. I was successful with some stuff, you know, like my portraits and nudes of men were published in several countries on several continents. And that should have told me something. And yet for years, I thought, well, you know, that's all cute and all that stuff. But I don't think people are taking me seriously. I shouldn't be here. And that took about a good 10 years for me to finally get over that and say, no, I do what I do. There are people who like what I do. Just move on. You know, don't hold yourself back all the time. And it's been the same with the writing. And so finally, I'm getting over that where I'm like, no, I do what I do. There's tons of people who will like this, and there's probably an equal amount of people who will not. And, you know, them's are the breaks.
So you chose to go the more traditional route rather than self-publish. Was self-publishing a thought at all, or did you always know you wanted to go with a more traditional publisher?
Well, it was my dream, you know, and that goes back to I guess, to the heydays of gay fiction, gay mystery fiction of the 80s and 90s, when you had a lot of fairly well-known publishing houses putting out all these books by gay authors. And that, to me, was fascinating and fantastic. And then it kind of disappeared. And I noticed during the time when I was writing my book, I try to read as much as I can. And I was downloading books for my Kindle and reading stuff or buying books that I found in the few bookstores that still had a gay mystery section or a gay section where you find something. And more often than not, I found books that there were like a lot of typos in it. It didn't, and I'm not saying that's the going rate, but perhaps I just picked the wrong books. But I thought, well, I know English is not my first language, and I can do as much as I can to get it right. But ultimately, I need someone to help me get this in the right shape to say, you know, you're losing track here a little bit. You need to focus and the story needs tightening, or perhaps this makes no sense. I don't see it anymore. So I really wanted a publisher who would do that, who would go the extra mile and say, no, we are interested in your book. We are reading it with you. We are editing it with you. And we'll put it out together and try to make this a success. And it was a chance meeting that ended up getting me together with Level Best Books and Sean Riley Simmons, who is my editor there. And it was a match made in heaven. It really was perfect the way it worked out. I did think about self-publishing for quite a while, but it was exactly that that held me back. I've seen a lot of self-published books where exactly that kind of attention to detail it seems to be missing, where someone said, I just want to get the story out. And that's fantastic. If it's a great story, you know, you should always, you got to go with what you feel is right for you. But if you have a million typos or it's just, it's hard to get through because the formatting is all wrong. I do find it hard as a reader personally. And I was afraid that if I were to go self-published, that could be one of the pitfalls, not to mention that it would have cost a ton of money to make sure that you are out there as professional as possible. So you could have hired an editor and all that stuff, but then you're $10,000-$20,000 in the hole, not knowing if anybody's ever going to read a single page of what you've written. And perhaps I also needed it as a booster by someone saying, no, we believe in you. We love your book. We love your story. We want to put it out there. And just try to go that way. And that's how it all worked out for me.
Regarding self-publishing and typos and that sort of thing, one of the beauties of Amazon, let's say, is anyone can write a book and get published.
Yes. Yeah.
The negative is anyone can write a book and get published.
Yeah.
Yeah. I self-published, and I know plenty of authors who self-publish that are outstanding. And it's sad because, okay, they're a self-publisher. They did well. But look at this guy. The ones that jump out that are not all that great, let's say, kind of put a damper on the whole independent publishing community. What was the process like when you decided, okay, I'm going to be traditionally published? How was that journey?
That was, well, it was tricky. I thought I was done 3 years ago. And 3 years ago, I went to Thriller Fest in New York and pitched my book. I was exceptionally nervous because I always suck when I have to talk to someone I've never met before. And I need to either talk about myself or I need to talk about my book. I get very, very tongue-tied. So it was quite a challenge to do that. But I decided to go ahead. And I was very, very successful. I pitched to 7 people, got 7 partial or full manuscript requests. I was like, what the hell? What just happened? I was just blown away until I got 7 rejections. And, you know, everybody was like, well, you know, da, da, da. The nice thing was that all but one really went out of their way to say how they liked my writing style, how they enjoyed what I'd done, that it was just not for them or that they didn't see enough of a market. Because I pitched to those who either said they were looking for own voice or for they were open to LGBTQ, and it ultimately did not work out. And I was very frustrated and very disappointed because I was on a very brief high where I was like, okay, this is going to work out. And then it didn't. And when that happened, I kind of fell into a bit of a hole. I was done. I've been working on this book for so many years. I really believed in it, but thought perhaps it's time to see the trees for the forest, or the other way around, the forest for the trees, and say, it's time to give up. It's just not going to happen for you. And my husband, Mark, is phenomenal. He's been so supportive throughout this entire process. And at some point he said, well, if this is what you want to do, then I should probably respect that, but I probably won't, because you're talented. I believe in you. You need to do this. You light up every time you talk about writing. Every time you talk about the book, it gives you so much joy. You giving up is not an option. But if you need to take your time, take your time. And then I was at the Writers Police Academy that they do. It's a group of retired law enforcement people, police officers, but also from special departments that put on a writer's retreat where you get to go and sort of experience and ask questions of the pros. But you're out in the field, quote unquote. If you have a license, you get to shoot a gun to see how that feels, or you get to do a car chase and stop another car, or do stuff like that. It's been difficult now that the pandemic hit. So most of it is now just online. But that's where I met Sean and her other dames of detection, they call themselves, that had taken over Level Best Books. And I'd lost out on a short contest. I was a loser. So that was the running gag of the evening. They were like, oh, it's so nice. We loved your story. I'm like, yeah, but I'm still a loser. I didn't win. And we just kind of struck a chord with each other and had a good time. And then when I was rejected again a little later for the same story, for the book, I reached out to Sean and I said, hey, I look at your roster of authors that you have. I don't see anybody doing a gay protagonist. Would you even be interested? And she was like, oh yeah, we love it. Send it to me. You know, I'm doing something else right now, but I'll get back to you. And sure enough, 3-4 months later, she came back. She was like, if you haven't sold the rights yet, I loved your book. I thought these were great characters. It was a great story. I'd love to work with you. How do you feel about it? And that finally happened 7 years in, more or less. So it took a while, but it was worth it. I had to become a better writer too. 4 years ago, I was not at the spot or at the station in my life I am today. I still have so much to learn. I still have to become a better writer on so many levels, I feel. You're never finished. Mm-hmm. But I'm so much better than I was 4 or even just 8 years ago. And I think the story became so much a better story for those reasons. So I'm actually glad that it took all that time to season me a bit better.
Going back to Thriller Fest and you being so nervous pitching your novel, as a general rule, not always, a lot of authors are very uncomfortable in social environments. And artists in general are not thrilled with marketing. It's just not something they want to do. So if you're self-published, you have to market yourself in that way. If you go to traditional publishing, you've got to market yourself maybe to an agent if you have to choose one, or a publisher either way. And it's not fun stuff for folks like us.
No, it isn't. And I'm still doing it because, of course, you know, I mean, I think it's kind of changed. I don't know how it was in the past. I think that for some of the big name authors, I'm sure there are huge budgets from the top five. And so I'm pretty sure they're going to do a lot for them as far as publishing goes. But throughout talking to all these other authors over time, it sounds like a lot of authors, even if you are with a subdivision of a big five or a smaller press like I am, that you do a lot of promotion yourself. It means your own money, your time. There's only so much they can do because of the quantity of people working there, the infrastructure given to them. So Level Best has been great about that. And I am very, very grateful, but I also have to do a lot of work myself. And that was always clear from the beginning. But as I said, I talked to other authors that are with different publishing houses. Some of them are bigger houses, and they all do it as well. So it just, I have to learn this now. And that's probably what makes everything so stressful right now. I've been doing this for 2-3 months. I came to the game a little late, I guess. And it's stressful. I'm exhausted at the end of the day. And then I look back and I'm like, I didn't really do all that much. I did, you know, I accomplished this, this, and this, and I reached out to here, here, and here. But the stress is so much that I am physically exhausted afterwards, and that's not fun. I'm hoping it's getting better with time, but, you know.
One thing I find really interesting regarding you is your novel, Blackout, is already a success in my eyes. It's had so much attention.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. And I got to say, for you already on Amazon to have review blurbs from Edwin Hill, who was a guest in the past here on the show.
I heard the show,
P.J. Vernon, he's coming up on the show. To have Edwin, P.J., and then not knowing that you were already booked on the show, Michael Nava to send me an email to say, hey, I've got this guy. He should be on your show.
Yes. I am.
Did you do to make all that happen?
Oh, my God.
Where were you in the right place at the right time?
Yeah, working my fingers to the bone. Maybe not my fingers, but no. I got to say, these guys were just amazing. Everybody, Gabriel Valjean, who is also a wonderful author, who's got a lot of books out, who also blurbed my book, and James L'Etoile. They were all so generous. James L'Etoile is actually the only person, and Michael Nava, who I ever had the privilege of meeting in person. I met James at a convention, and I've been a longtime fan of Michael's for so many years. And a few years ago, I don't know what got in my head, but I was like, I just reread all of his books at the time, and I was like, I just have to tell him how much I love the book. So I reached out to him. He goes, oh, I'm in Palm Springs. Do you want to get together for a coffee? I'm like, what the fuck? It was crazy. I was like, oh, yeah, sure, totally, let's do this. So we got together, had a really nice time. And I thought it was just the nicest thing for, you know, someone that I looked up to and admired, who was, in my eyes, is a famous person for all, to take out time to talk to me, of all people. And then I started, again, a little late. I wish I had started earlier to just get into this whole writing community thing. I've always done this sort of by myself. I wrote the books. I didn't feel I belonged. I went to these conventions, but I usually kept to myself. And so I had a really hard time just reaching out to people because I always felt like, well, who wants to talk to me? Who wants to, you know, and that's also not a great way to approach people, I think. I'm easygoing and easy to talk to, but I get tongue-tied at these events. So when the time came, I'd already read PJ's book, When You Find Me, and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a great book. And it was a mutual acquaintance who actually made the connection. She said, oh, he's great. And he's always, you know, he's trying to write a book that has a great protagonist in it. And I don't think he had sold Bathhouse at the time. And she was like, well, just reach out to him and say hi. And finally, I did with a query letter question. And he was just nice as can be and helped me and said, this sounds great. Your book sounds great, whatever. So when the time finally came, I reached out to him again and I said, I am sorry to bother you. And you have every out in the world if you don't want to. But would you at all be interested in reading the book? And he was like, yeah, sure. Send it to me. And same goes for Edwin Hill. I had read his first book, and he's a very good friend of my publisher. And she said, you should maybe reach out to Edwin and ask. And he was nice enough to do it, even though he was right in the middle of promoting Watcher, his latest. And I was just floored that all these people who have busy careers and have their own stuff to worry about would talk to someone they don't know from a hole in the wall simply because someone else said, hey, maybe you should give this guy a look-see and maybe he's got something you would be interested in. So I am forever and tremendously grateful that all of these people took the time to not only read the book, but came back with such beautiful, wonderful blurbs that really gave me a really big booster at the time. Finally thinking, okay, if your peers, people that I wouldn't even dare to call my peers, because I'm like, no, I'm here and they're so much further up, that they would give you that sort of, what do you call it? Those accolades and said, no, we like what you did. Congratulations. That meant the world to me. I was on cloud nine for several weeks when that happened. That was just fantastic.
I know you're involved in writing organizations. You're in Sisters in Crime.
Yes.
And just so our listeners know, Sisters in Crime started as an organization to primarily promote women authors in the crime genre, but it is no longer just women. many men that are part of the organization. So wanted to get that across for those that aren't familiar with it. And you also joined Mr. Writers of America.
Yes.
Do you think they helped you in that journey?
The local chapter, yes, absolutely. The local chapter is really the chapter I am in touch with for the most part. And I think, I don't know how that is in other states, but obviously whenever an event is taking place, those are the ones I can make, because if anything happens internationally and it's in New York, I'm usually probably not there. So I got to say, I'm very grateful for the local chapter. They already printed me in the newsletter. They put on some really amazing in-person events to go to that were always free. So they did that actually, one of them anyway, they did co-jointly with Sisters in Crime. They probably did more. But that was amazing. So yeah, so I think it's totally worth the membership being there. And I think what's wonderful is that all these organizations have a, probably not the right word, but like a database. They have a wealth of information from all these famous authors that have been a part of the organization for so many years to help other writers that are unknowns or perhaps less experienced to either get information, you can ask questions and you get answers, or they have an entire list of where to contact people to, you know, put your name out there if you want to get in touch with people doing podcasts or advertise in magazines, how to approach them, where to go, you get special deals. So it's totally worth it because it's just wonderful to be a part of the crime fiction community. I have to say, I never expected to be this welcomed by a writing community as I have been with these events. Whenever I had a chance to go, everybody's just always so interested, even though they've never seen me before. And I'm sure they are like that with everybody else. It's just a very welcoming field. That's at least how I've experienced it. When I've heard that other organizations that perhaps are not in the crime genre, but a different genre, are a lot more competitive, where people are more like, this is what I'm doing, and don't you steal my style, don't do this, don't do that. It seems like the crime fiction genre is just a very giving community. That's at least how I've experienced it. And that gave me a lot of confidence to move forward and do what I'm doing.
I have never met an author, and I'm sure there's plenty that exist, I have never met an author that considers other authors competition. And it's very rare to see an author not willing to help somebody trying to get started. And I think that's wonderful. I had a lot of help when I get started. And so now when people ask me, I jump on it as well. Time consuming.
Yeah,
I'm glad,
sure,
to, I'm glad
sure.
I did.
Yeah,
I need to ask you something because we brought it up before. As I said, you've got some amazing photos online. Your pictures of Palm Springs, I adore. I also love mid-century modern. You've done fashion photos, and there are some nudes, but you know, they're sensual.
Yes.
Where are the real naked pictures? You put out calendars, and you put out books. Why aren't those pictures up on your website? Not that I am interested in seeing all these naked men, of course. It's just a curiosity question.
Well, there are several reasons. I got to say that at some point, as grateful as I am and was at the time for having had some of my work published here and there and getting the chance to do greeting cards and calendars and a small, obscure coffee table book, at some point, I wanted to move forward. All these photographs had been done with natural light in black and white, with black and white film. They were all developed and then blown up and all that stuff. And at the time, I'd started in the early mid 2005, 6, 7, somewhere around there. I started shooting digital and everything started to be color and I tried to go in a different direction. I learned how to shoot with light, with artificial light. I became a lot more knowledgeable on how to set lights, how to set a mood, how to create something out of nothing, where you cannot just say, oh, well, we'll just let the sun take over and we'll go with whatever. And suddenly I felt like this is what I want to do now. And people kept coming back saying, oh, but we love your nudes. Can we reprint this? Can we do this? And I got tired of it, which is really a horrible thing to say because it's what actually made me a little bit successful at the time to have all these beautiful covers to look back on. Blue Magazine in Australia was a really good client. And that was one of my favorite magazines in the world. They did such an amazing job. And I felt people had seen it enough. So I kind of removed it from an earlier version of the webpage. Also, it became a bit of a problem in the sense that I never showed anything in the book, yes, but and in the calendars, I didn't mind if you saw a dick or a pair of balls or whatever. Guys are naked, clearly. So yes, you're going to see naked people. But on the website, it became a bit more problematic to sell myself as a professional that people wanted to hire for the advertising job. Now, Switzerland is pretty open-minded, and I never really felt it was an issue. But I can tell you, the more professional stuff that was up there, that was not daylight, that was not naked men or just a portrait, the more popular I became to get a little job here, a little job there. I worked with an eyewear store for several years, and we put out these fun little campaigns that we did, usually at my apartment. There's like 15 people running around, the styling the models, but they were naked. And then you just had glasses, eyewear that they used. And we had a tremendous fun time doing that. And so that was accepted much more because people reacted to it because you sold a product. And it was more stylish, of course. I had perfected my light. And so it was not as raw, if you will, as the outdoor or even indoor natural light photographs. So a lot of that disappeared. And then when I moved to the States, I even more so cleaned up my act because a lot of people said to me, whether they were right or not, I don't know, but they said, you got to be careful if you want to get hired, if you want to be taken seriously, you have to sort of have a clean act so that people will hire you. In Palm Springs, it's probably a different story. Probably more people would hire me if there was more meat on the pages. But I felt it was a good balance, and I just kind of toned it down a little bit. Also, a lot of that stuff, of course, is still originally on film. And when my book came out, it was called Undressed, and it came out in 2002. When that came out, they had digitized those negatives, but they had the rights to those. And I don't even know what happened to those scans. The book is out of print, has been out of print for a long, long time. But if I were to present these pictures again, I'd have to go through the trouble of rescanning them in the best possible quality so that they look like they're supposed to look. And that is something I will do, absolutely. I have a whole list of photographs that I would love to see printed on a beautiful canvas or whatever. But I've not gotten around to it. It just takes a lot of time to do that. And then, of course, you have to sit down and start cleaning everything up because you shot it with film. So it takes time to make sure that a photograph is perfectly presentable. And one day I will do it, but it's taken a backseat.
Yeah, you've got a lot of balls that you're juggling right now. So totally understandable. And I can't believe we've reached this time already. We're coming to the end. It's time for awkward questions authors get.
Goody.
And I know you listen to the show, so you know what
yes.
to expect.
Yes.
Real quick for the listeners, these are awkward, rude, bizarre, strange questions. We never know which one we're going to get. Real questions that authors have gotten that I surveyed. So hold on while I spin the wheel.
Yeah.
Okay, Marco, you touched on this regarding what others have done, but I'll just read it. Can you read my manuscript for free and write me a report on what needs fixing?
Okay. Well, I always try to help if I can help. But I have to say, yeah, it's tricky. I had the same thing with photography. People would call and say, I just need this picture. Can't you just do it like for like 5 seconds? I just need one shot. Well, excuse me, to get to one good shot, it very much depends. I think if someone asks the right way and you realize they really need help as opposed to just trying to exploit you, absolutely.
Yeah,
I've done a lot of stuff for free over the years. But yeah, if you realize that someone is just kind of, that's their shtick, then it's kind of like, yeah, no, thanks. Here are my rates.
Well, again, my guest is Marco Corcari, and his novel is Blackout, which if you're listening to this show when it comes out on March 30th, the book is available today.
Yay.
If you're listening later, it's out already.
Yes.
Go buy his book.
Run.
I think you're going to do really well. You have a lot of people behind you, and I think you've done a great job pushing yourself. So my best to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for having me here. And yeah, fingers crossed.